Leading off the hour, the Moles Bill Resnick and Christian Williams continued their discussion of how to confront the police, limit their authority, and also keep them from joining with the far right and its military supporters. To someday, as the country falls into economic environmental crisis, declare martial law and take over. Williams is an activist who has worked in efforts to democratize the police and has written several books, including Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and Life During Wartime, Resisting Counterinsurgency. Here is Bill Resnick with Christian Williams.
Hi, Christian Williams. Welcome to KABU.
Hello, Bill.
We're here for the second of a three-part interview on the police and how to keep them from becoming the armed force of a fascist takeover should the U.S. and planet start collapsing into a great combined economic global warming crisis, which seems likely to happen. Could be soon, could be in 50 years, because international ruling elites reject the science and just refuse to stop. In the first part, we discussed police strategies to suppress the left insurgent protest. Police before and after World War II basically used what a number of sociologists have called escalated force, but escalated force with batons and water cannons and snarling dogs as captured on TV. They gave the police a bad black eye when they used that tactic on civil rights demonstrators, so the police adapted to that. They needed a new tactic. It's called negotiated management, is what they tried to impose. But negotiated management also didn't work so good. That's because some groups refused to negotiate their rights away, like on issues like where and when they could march and demonstrate and the signage and numerous other things. The police wanted to guide them, and that was rejected. So police then adapted again with a strategy called strategic incapacitation. Strategic incapacitation also hasn't worked so well. In the second part, I begin the discussion of why it hasn't been very successful for the police. But unfortunately, it's been even worse, it seems to me, for the left. In the second part, I'm going to begin the discussion of what happened to the protest movements and police demonstrator relations in the period of strategic incapacitation, which began right after the Battle of Seattle, basically. It began in the year 2000. So what happened after that? First, it seems to me the police kept militarizing equipment, robocops, special units, training in quick strikes, training in intimidating, training in the equipment and logistics of arresting and containing large numbers of people. All of this got funding and advice from the federal government, including the military, the FBI, consultants, and tactics and training also from the Israelis, who, of course, perfected the science of breaking up movements and making it seem that it was all in self-defense. We were under attack. A second development, of course, was the rise of the alt-right neo-fascists, who developed a strategy for dealing with the left and provoking them and, in fact, claiming somehow to be the forces of law and order, like this Proud Boy movement who inflicts themselves on Portland. They're reaching out to the police, making friends with them, portraying themselves as God-loving patriots compared to those intolerant, police-hating, violent leftists. And then the third development that's occurred after the year 2000 and our period of strategic incapacitation, there's the emergence of parts of the left, the antifas, who want to confront both the neo-fascists and the police. And these three groups come to dominate the media coverage and indeed popular memories of the events and actions, since they are striking in their outfits and theatrical and loud in their behavior. This seems to me very unfortunate and plays into the hands of the fascists and the worst elements of the police, and it becomes the most memorable part of the demonstration. Christian, do you accept that analysis, or do you propose a different perspective?
Well, those are all things that have gained a new prominence in the last handful of years, but none of those are especially new developments on their own. I mean, the process of militarization really began in the late 1960s as a direct result of the civil rights movement.
And the drug wars. They armed themselves as tactical squads.
Yes, although Nixon's advisor, Haldeman, has been forthright or was later forthright in saying that the drug war was really just invented as a scheme to attack black communities. And if you look at how it's played out, the focus of the police attention has not necessarily been where the drug problem was greatest. It's just where black people were concentrated. And the effect on those communities has been completely devastating, which, of course, was the point. I actually consider the drug war part of the counterinsurgency operation, not a sort of separate apolitical development. So militarization's been underway for decades. The connection between official police agencies and unofficial right-wing forces has been – that's been a longstanding relationship that really goes back all the way to the development of the Ku Klux Klan in the 19th century. The Klan – I talk about this some in Our Enemies in Blue, but it shares a common ancestor with modern police forces in the form of the Slave Patrol, that were these bodies of basically every – adult white man had to do his turn in the South on a patrol, riding between plantations, enforcing the slave codes, and that practice of riding together and intimidating the black population was something that people early in the period of the Klan had already had experience with because of their experience in the slave patrols. And so there's this deep they're like cousins. There's this deep institutional genealogy that the organized racists of the non-state variety and the police share. And so there's been a tendency for collaboration. There's been a tendency for having members in common, you know, all the way back since the beginning of the institution. So the current version of this is the sort of alt-right Proud Boys stuff. But it's a new instantiation of a very old pattern. In terms of the development of militancy on the left, I mean, in general, I think people are right to resist, and they are going to inevitably resist in a variety of different ways. And sometimes that's taken the form of violent confrontation, and sometimes that takes other forms, and sometimes those tactics are well advised, and sometimes those tactics are foolish. And, you know, that's just sort of how history goes. So at the moment, we're in a period where that type of action is at least grabbing the headlines, although I don't know that it is actually that much more prominent than it has been at other points. But it's not a new development. It's not anything outside of the sort of historical lineage of left-wing activity.
This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland. Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole Variety Hour, talking to Christian Williams, who's been active in efforts to democratize and hold accountable the police, and wrote the book Our Enemy in Blue, Police and Power in the U.S. So, Christian, we're here for the second of a three-part interview on the police and how to keep them from becoming the armed force of a fascist takeover should the U.S. and planet start collapsing into a great combined economic and global warming crisis, which seems likely to happen, could be soon, could be in 50 years, because the internationalist ruling elites reject the science and just refuse to stop. In the first part, we discussed police strategies to suppress left insurgent protests. They've changed over the last 100 years, with what's called escalated force being abandoned by the police when in the civil rights struggles that gave them and the right a black eye. So they tried what's called negotiated management, and that's when many left groups refused to negotiate their rights away. The police developed a strategy called strategic incapacitation. That's now running into trouble and created, however, a very unfortunate situation in which the battles between the radical right and left antifas gave the police an excuse for breaking up and disturbing left demonstrations. In the second interview, Christian Williams was dubious about the left being able to reach out to the police to somehow influence them to stop their violence against the left. He argued that the police have a duty, and Christian Williams argued that the police have a duty, and they're organized to keep order and protect the properties, which puts them into conflict with the left and the poor, who seek a very different society as to income and power. He contends these structural factors lead to police developing right-wing values in politics. That's, of course, absolutely correct, but it ignores what's crucial. How far right do they go? Who did they affiliate with? Do they go with the outright fascists to declare martial law? Or do they remain loyal to those elites who decide to accept the popular left, who may have won a plebiscite or election? In fact, the corporate right did that. Even though a lot of their properties were, in effect, nationalized, they complained a lot. They were very angry. But they basically accepted a left victory under Roosevelt. Elections were won by the left, and the Roosevelt administration came to direct the recovery of the U.S. from the Depression and also directed victory in World War II. Well, the police now today see their best interests lie with continuation of a constitutionalist state, or will they see themselves somehow better off with the fascists to declare martial law when the country goes into crisis that most scientists, of course, see as happening if we don't deal with global warming and other environmental problems? And it doesn't appear to me that any of the elites in the world want to really deal with them. So no doubt there exists a structured antagonism between the left, allied with the bottom half, and the police, protecting the property and privilege of the elites. But that antagonism takes different forms in different periods. So it seems to me our job is, and we're near the end of this interview, so although you're going to get the last word, Christian, it seems to me our job is to try to maintain relations with the police that would prevent their complete identification with the most radical right. We have to have relations with them so they do not come to see the right as their comrades. So that if the left, for example, won an election, a plebiscite clearly favored by most people as a political force best able to reconstruct the economy and production in a time of crisis, it seems to me that the police could be kept out of the arms of the right and in favor of accepting a left in power, even if they didn't like most of our policies. It seems to me that's our goal, not to win the police to our side. That's not going to happen. There's always going to be conflict, but it doesn't have to lead to police identification with and complete support for the authoritarian or fascist state.
There's a lot in that to address. I'm going to try to focus on just a couple of points. One is how the right wing relates to the police, and different parts of the right do it differently, and the right does it differently at different times. Like there is an element of right-wing ideology that is very law and order. And, you know, historically, the John Birch Society organized support your police rallies and that sort of thing. There's also an element of the far right that views the state hostily. And there's an element of antagonism on that side as well. So the relationship between the police and organized right-wing forces it's often going to depend on which right-wing forces. The relationship on the left to the police, I mean, I think you're right that we're not going to sort of win them over. In fact, I'm not even sure that that's a coherent notion. But I think we do have a need to sort of neutralize them in that conflict. And some of that, I think, will depend on maintaining and reinforcing constraints on police action, police autonomy, how much the police as an institution can set their own agenda. Some of that, I think, will depend on weakening the legitimacy of the institution overall, such that the police are not viewed in society generally as these sort of referees, but instead are seen as players in the game. And some of that, I think, will depend on, in fact, undermining the morale within the institution itself so as to encourage dissenting voices within policing, so as to encourage whistleblowing, so as to starve them of recruits, to make it really increase their sense of being sort of isolated and embattled, and therefore making it an unappealing place for people to go to. Now, on the one hand, I think the effect of that should be to decrease the overall strength of the police in society and to decrease their role in society overall so that it matters less what the people within the institution, what their policy preferences are. I guess I do have to admit, though, that that sort of political war of attrition may also make the elements of the right that are supportive of the police and that are appealing to them in terms of their own feelings of isolation and alienation and resentment, it may solidify the affinities that are already there. I think that's unfortunate for many reasons, but I think that it's ultimately more important that we diminish and dismantle the power of the police as the institution rather than that we steer it in more of a contained liberal democratic direction, and then we incur the cost of re-legitimizing it and reaffirming its position in society overall.
Yes. I think we sort of agree on that. I might put a little bit more emphasis on maintaining constitutionalism, but diminishing and dismantling is a good strategic sort of direction that has to happen. This enormous increase in policing and jails and the rest of it and the whole set of oppressive institutions. I think in the next installment, we can talk about that process to somehow corral the police is to diminish, dismantle, as well as create within the forces that remain some commitment to not participate in a martial law coup, who might even, in fact, resist the police who do want to join with the right and declare martial law. It seems to me that's also important. There's a whole number of things that could be done and a whole number of things that should be done with the left in terms of our response to the police and how we confront them. This was a good discussion, Christian. In the next installment, we'll be able to talk in much more detail about the way in which we can defang or limit the power of police and reduce the chances of a joint police authoritarian right force developing to, in fact, take control of the country. So thanks a lot for talking today.